Param F. Dakkari and Mark Seward joining me to talk about cybersecurity understanding on Capitol Hill. Param, I want to start with you. You're a co-founder and senior fellow at the Institute for Critical Infrastructure Technology. Tell me about the mission of your organization and how that pertains to sharing information on Capitol Hill. Thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us. So ICIT's mission is very simple but very important. We exist to support and protect the critical infrastructure sectors of our country. We designed the organization around Presidential Policy Directive 21, which is what Department of Homeland Security obviously is focused on. We primarily look at five sectors: government and defense, energy, financial, critical manufacturing. What we do to support our mission is provide objective, nonpartisan advisement to the legislative community. We were talking a bit earlier, there's a wide spectrum of technology understanding on the Hill. You have some staffers and offices that have a good understanding of technology. You have their cyber intelligence staffers who have engineering backgrounds and technology backgrounds. On the other end of the spectrum, you have some individuals and offices that truly have very limited understandings of technology. What we do is we act as a conduit between technology experts, be them from academia, organizations like ISU Squared, or the vendor community, and those offices and the committees and caucuses that are focused on cyber legislation. Mm-hmm. And so we provide expert objective opinion on either specific pieces of legislation or issues like the OPM breach, like hackings of hospitals and things of that nature.
And so your goal is to be kind of an impartial observer of all of these issues, to be able to give impartial advice to the members.
That is absolutely correct. We do not, you know, I want to be very clear, we're not a lobby organization. We don't go in there and take any position on legislation. We go in there truly to educate, and we are essentially a trusted advisor to these offices and to these committees. So they have a safe space to go to. If they say, look, we need to understand, how does encryption work? How does malware work? What happened at OPM? And they can give us a call, and we put out a briefing, and we go in there and provide that education to them.
Mark, what's your role in working with Param and the organization?
Sure. Well, I'm one of the fellows of the organization, which means that I'm called upon to talk about some of the more cutting-edge technologies and some of the more interesting things that are happening out in the private sector in innovation. So they can begin to look at aligning regulation that they might want to draft or laws that they might want to draft with technologies that are here today now, not technologies that are 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. That's always been a problem with legislation, is that there, by the time legislation gets through Congress and passes, the technology or the standard or the technique or process that they're talking about is often 18 months to 2 years old. So my role is to help Param sort of jumpstart that process with the legislators and their staffs.
Your observation's particularly acute when it comes to cybersecurity, Mark. Param, what's the reception that you get as you go to Capitol Hill? They've been working on cybersecurity legislation, it seems like, for literally for half a decade. It seems like a decade. But do they understand that time is passing them by and the threat landscape is passing them by as they try to decide how to do cyber legislation and don't seem to get around to actually doing it?
Yes, I think they understand it. And I think as more breaches are happening, and certainly OPM was definitely a wake-up call, it affected them personally. It's no longer something that they're seeing on the news. This last year, and certainly the last 6 months, has been quite a change on the Hill. I think that as the media has picked up on more of these stories, and you know, you literally have, it's no longer only those of us in the industry. You have your friends, your mom and dad calling you saying, hey, what's going on? Do I need to be worried about this? I think we've seen a shift across the country, certainly on the Hill.
Yeah, the story that I have told on the air a couple of times is that when we learned about the first breach, I thought, well, this is a terrible thing for the people in my audience, but I'm lucky it doesn't affect me.
Right.
Second breach, I thought the same thing at first until it occurred to me that a person that lives on my street had applied for a security clearance, and one of the people he listed as a potential reference was me.
Yeah.
And so I'm there now with everybody else. And so I imagine that's opening up the level of questioning that you're getting when you talk to people on the Hill.
It certainly does. I mean, I filled out one of the F-86 forms myself to get a clearance, and I've also been a reference for somebody who was going to get a clearance themselves. So it certainly affected me, although mine was about 10 years ago. So if they got everything, mm-hmm. which is rumored to be the case, then my information is out there as well, except unfortunately they don't know where I live because that was 10 years ago.
So you are headed to the Hill within the next several weeks to brief specifically on cybersecurity. What is it that what's the message that you intend to take to the Hill as you talk about things like the Internet of Things, the future of cybersecurity, securing healthcare information as the government becomes a bigger, a more important part of that landscape, and so on?
Well, you know, we as an institute, we're on the Hill pretty much every couple of weeks. Most recently, we've been on the Hill talking about the OPM breach. I think there's a few messages that we're taking right now. First of all, multi-layered security is critical. Unfortunately, we don't see a lot of multi-layered security strategies in the government. We need multi-layered security. Actually, what Mark, the reason we brought him on board as a fellow is that one of his specialties is user behavior analytics. User behavior analytics and encryption are two recommendations that we're making as an institute that the government needs to start investing in. With the OPM breach, we had some statements made from OPM saying that because they were had a network that was built on some COBOL technologies, that encryption was not possible. That actually is not the case. And even user behavior analytics can be applied to some of the older technologies. So, you know, we're trying to basically get the government to understand how to use more advanced multi-layered security to protect themselves.
The concept of COBOL, and I when I refer to the I know it's a language, I understand what it is, but people tend to talk about it, especially recently, more conceptually than operationally, just because of the idea that it's so old and yet it's still around. But this concept has come up not just at OPM, but also at the Internal Revenue Service recently.
Certainly, and there are certainly a lot of government agencies that have legacy systems out there that are built on code that is 10 to 15, even 20 years old in some cases. And I think that that's just a fact of life, that that many of these systems were built to last, just like many of the systems we have that are managing our water supplies or our electricity grid. Most of those systems were built to last 20 to 25 years. And some of the systems that are in sort of embedded inside of the federal government that that have to be up 24/7 that do this kind of thing were written back then, and they just simply haven't been updated to modern standards, which makes a couple of things difficult. First, it makes security a lot harder for that information. As was said here, encryption in COBOL systems is particularly difficult. But the second thing that happens is that, and where user behavior analytics comes in, is it makes it difficult to associate identity with the people who access those systems. In many cases, you can't use a modern system like, say, Active Directory or LDAP to regulate or control who has access to that particular COBOL system at any given time. And because those two are incompatible, it leaves out a layer of identity that's crucial, not only in access, but also tracking different identities.
Parham, you mentioned that it is the OPM said we can't secure these systems because they're COBOL systems. And Mark, you mentioned that securing them is difficult. That's not impossible, though. Those words aren't synonyms. And so I see a little bit of space between what OPM is saying, and you're, Parham, not the only person that said that it's possible to secure these systems.
Yeah. There are systems that you can add outside of the COBOL system that act as sort of authentication brokers mm-hmm. that will sort of decide whether or not you are allowed, given your access level, to access that particular system. And that information is extremely useful in tracking user behaviors that that may be odd for a particular user inside of the organization.
And Mark, what's the state of the art? Maybe not even that high a level. What are some elements of identity management that the federal government isn't leveraging, maybe, that they should be? And would anything that's on the market that's available in the private sector in identity management have staved off something like we saw with the OPM cyber breach?
Yeah, it's interesting. Identity management solutions have been around actually for a very long time, but they wouldn't really have staved off the OPM breach. And I'll just quickly explain why, and then I'll talk a little bit about user behavior analytics. The reason why is that those systems are sort of triggered on yes or no, one or zero, black and white. And either you're allowed access or you're not. And if you have the right set of credentials, you can gain access. But what if someone has actually stolen your credentials? What if an attacker has actually put a piece of malware on your system that is acting on your behalf to try to access something? those systems are going to allow you access simply because they make a decision based on one or zero, yes or no. And they see you and they say, hey, we know you, we'll let you pass. So that's the way those particularly work. And the difference is, and where the cutting edge kind of system comes in, is with user behavior analytics. And what that does is it uses a number of cutting edge technologies, machine learning, and what we call an identity state engine, to learn all of the normal accesses and access characteristics of all of the individuals in the agency. And when it does that, it says, okay, I'm also going to compare all of those actions to everyone in your peer group. So if you work in the secretarial pool, or you work in a particular group within an agency, for example, and I do something, it's going to say, hey, is that normal for you historically? And then it's also going to ask, is that normal for everyone else in your group, in your peer group? And then if it's normal for all of those things, then all right, that's fine. But if it isn't, if it begins to show some sort of divergence between what you would do normally and what an attacker would do who has completely different objectives from you as a normal employee, that's what user behavior systems, or user behavior analytics systems rather, are actually going to do. They're going to see that divergence and alert you to say, hey, Tom is using his credentials in this way, from this place, at this time, touching these particular systems. And we've and by the way, changing identities midstream, mm-hmm. and we've never seen him do any of those sorts of things before. Is that really Tom? And if you see enough divergence, you can be sure that's not Tom. That's an attacker actually who's stolen Tom's identity and is using that to try to gain access to data he shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. Parham, when you take concepts like this to the Hill, we talk broadly about the kind of reception that you get and the kind of questions and so on. But what's your sense of what the reception is like to those kinds of ideas? It strikes me that there are probably some places you go and those concepts lay those concepts out the way that Mark just did, and the response is kind of a blank face because there's just not a depth of understanding.
I'll not take that personally.
No, I don't mean it as a reflection on the way you explain them, because I understood it. I'm not certainly an expert, but I also understand that someone who's even in a policymaking position on the Hill is not necessarily in a position where he or she is able to be on the very edge of what's happening in topics like identity management, despite the fact that we have selected these leaders collectively as a nation to make policy in these very important areas.
Right. And that's why that's a great point. And that's why the education process is critical. And that's why it's important for us to be nonpartisan, talk to as many groups as possible. We talk to cybersecurity committees. We talk to homeland security committees. We talk to healthcare organizations. Committees and caucuses. Mm-hmm. So when we have these discussions and we go at it from an educational perspective, and we don't just talk about one technology or one angle. We say, look, what's the goal here? Is the goal to protect the nation? Is the goal to protect the agency and protect the data? Well, here's what you need to do, and it takes all these different types of technologies and all these different strategies. And when we explain it to them from that angle and that perspective, then you start to see these lights come on. Mm-hmm. And to your point, when we're not talking about it from a purely technical perspective, we were having a discussion earlier today. The reason why you don't go into these legislative offices and show them the NIST framework and say, well, here's the answer, just implement this, make this law, because it's not that simple. These are not technology people that you're talking to here. Mm-hmm. So what we do in our briefs is we take a non-technical approach to these discussions, and then when we have these in-person meetings, we then simplify the discussion, if you will, present these ideas in business terms and in policy terms, if you will, and in that dialogue and in that context, now you start making progress.
What is the most difficult part of that education process? Is it that concept of cracking the nut of explaining technical stuff in non-technical terms, or is there something else that you found to be more difficult?
No, that is the most difficult part. That and actually, it's easier to talk to people who don't necessarily have cybersecurity expertise than it is to some that do in a lot of cases, because those that do have certain mindsets that they come to the table with. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to them about new concepts like user behavior analytics, their brain begins to start working, well, that can't work, this isn't right, I've never seen that before. They become instant skeptics. And actually going and talking just like I would talk to I mean, I'm hating to use this example, my mother about how this all works, and I have actually done that, is more interesting and is more fulfilling for the staffers because they're able to, I lay it out in terms that are hopefully simple to understand, and they all get the fact they log into systems. They all get the fact that if you use federal systems, those logs are going to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They just haven't really thought through where those are going to go. And depending on their level of expertise or the level of education in cybersecurity, they can begin to understand the concepts. And when they do, my hope is anyway that they can begin to write about this or talk about it in a way that will allow them to either write legislation or do whatever they need to do.
And I will add something that there is a tremendous hunger on the Hill for this information. And again, I think that we've seen it growing. That's why ICIT has made the impact that it has. And especially with the OPM breach, when we put this briefing out that we just did a few weeks ago, our phones lit up. We've had back-to-back meetings all week, and it's going to continue, as you pointed out, over the next several weeks. Mm-hmm. But the thirst for this information is kind of at a point that we've never seen before. And that's very telling. I think that this is one area where parties don't matter. Both sides are coming together, and they understand that there's a true issue in the federal government. Systems and agencies need to be modernized. They need to do something about it. And again, this education process, even if they don't understand the technology, they're willing to put aside egos, if you will, and say, let's come to the table. Tell us what we need to know and what do we need to do about it.
Is most of the feedback that you get framed in budget terms or is it framed in solutions terms?
Actually, it's mostly framed in solutions terms, which for me, I actually would have thought the other way around.
Yeah, me too.
But it's actually in solutions terms, and they actually are looking to address problems, things they see ripped from the headlines, so to speak, or particular issues that they've got that's related to their particular committee. So, for example, if we talk about to a couple of legislators who have staffs interested in health legislation and securing that kind of data, they approach it from the health segment mindset.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been pretty good as far as, you know, it's not a budgetary thing at all. It's just understanding concepts and really wanting to know what's going on.
And that said, you know, ICIT, we're an advisory organization, so we don't go on there talking to them about budgets or legislation from that angle. So that also could be that's not what we're there advising on. There could mm-hmm. be other discussions happening behind the scenes that we're not there for. And I think that's also why we're so impactful, because we go there purely to educate them on the technology.
But as prevalent and as pervasive as budget discussions have been, especially in the last 18 months to 3 years, I think I would have expected the same thing as you did, Mark, that a lot of the conversations would revolve around whatever your solution is, whatever your advice is, how much it's going to cost.
Right. I think that reflects an urgency of the problem.
That's right.
I mean, everybody, you know, every agency is wondering if they're going to be the next OPM.
Yeah.
I think this, you know, for years, this has been sort of slowly creeping along, all of these different breaches. I mean, the White House breach, the Department of State breach, all of those have been sort of creeping along, and they roll into the news and then back out. This one has stuck around. I mean, and I think it's sort of this sort of blood on the floor, if you will, kind of moment that people realize, okay, it's time to really do something, and I'm not going to talk about this in budgetary terms. I need to get educated on what's going on and how I can write legislation that's going to be impactful.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for the conversation. We're out of time, but I appreciate the update, and we'll look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks
a lot.
Thank you.